sometimes I worry I don't know what to say to people. And guess what? They tell me what I should say to them. And when people are saying, I'm so lost and I don't know what to do, they just told us something about what's going on inside of them. And so paraphrasing is a great way for us to better connect.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to COVID-19 Heroes. I'm your host, Lorraine Schneider, and today we dive into the very important topic of mental health. Please know that we do discuss sensitive topics during this interview. If you or someone you know is in crisis, please call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline at 1-800-273-8255. So today I'm joined by Brian Steffen, who works for the Didi Hirsch Suicide Prevention Center. And Brian does a great job of not just explaining some of the struggles people are currently experiencing and giving helpful tips for what people can say to loved ones in need, but he also sheds a whole lot of hope, light, and optimism. In the age of social distancing, there's no better gift than a go gift. What is a go gift? It's a way to give loved ones meaningful, personalized gifts by bringing together friends and family from all over the world. Everyone contributes by writing messages that get added to a personal, private website. One new message gets delivered every day, so the more messages, the longer the gift lasts, and the receiver will always have their own little slice of the internet to look back on. Head to gogift.com/COVID, that is GOGYFT.com/COVID. GoGift, the gift that keeps on giving. Hi, Brian. Thank you for being on today's show of COVID-19 Heroes. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Lorraine. Thank you for having me.
Brian, you work for Didi Hirsch Mental Health Services. Who was Didi Hirsch and what services does your workplace provide?
So Didi Hirsch was a former social worker, an MSW, just like me. And she was a philanthropist who, along with her husband, donated the seed money that created our new headquarters for the agency when it became a federally designated community mental health center in the 1970s. So our full name is Didi Hirsch Mental Health Services, and we're a nonprofit organization that provides mental health and substance use services to low-income children and adults in Los Angeles and Orange counties. And so for over 75 years, the agency has been dedicated to the mission of serving communities where stigma or poverty limit access. And every year, we help more than 150,000 children and adults at our 10 locations and 100 schools throughout Los Angeles. And the part of the organization that I'm a part of, Didi Hirsch, we have an incredible suicide prevention programs and services that help individuals and families, not only in Southern California, but also nationwide. And ours is actually the first ever in the country, the first ever suicide prevention center. It was started in 1958, and it really grew in earnest after Marilyn Monroe's death by suicide. So I'm really proud to be part of Didi Hirsch and our suicide prevention center. And at our center, every year we're called on to help people. And every year it's more and more people who are calling. They're either in crisis themselves, a suicidal or a non-suicidal crisis, or oftentimes they're calling for someone else and they want to know how to help them, maybe a family member or a friend. And in 2019, our center, which is free and 24/7 and multilingual, we had more than 130,000 calls, chats, and text messages, again, from all over the country. So this is a really amazing organization, and we do a lot.
For some people, the stay-at-home order has been quite the positive experience. No more commuting and sitting in traffic, increased family and leisure time, and you finally get around to doing things that you never could before. Meanwhile, for others, this has been a really hard time, maybe even the hardest in their life, because they're experiencing the loss of someone they've loved, or they have lost their financial stability, or they're battling loneliness. Are we able to see one side weigh out the other more statistically, or is it too early to tell?
This is really hard. And my job at the Suicide Prevention Center, I'm a shift supervisor, so I support our shifts of counselors who are talking to people in crisis. So I support our counselors who are actually talking to people either over the phone or the computer, because we have both those services. So yeah, so we've been talking to a lot of people, a lot of people, and our numbers have gone up and up and up. So this is a really complicated time, and we're hearing that from our callers and each other, the counselors, the staff, all of us. And in fact, there was a counselor who came in yesterday who said that being at home, it's disorienting. I remember it was really powerful. He said that one moment it feels like a vacation, and another moment being at home, it feels like kind of like a prison at times. And both of those are true. And that's something that we offer on the line, and we can explore with people that it doesn't have to be one or the other in life, and certainly not with this pandemic right now. All of these things are possible. And we can explore that, and we do. The hardest thing of all is people picking up the phone and calling us. And once they've done so, which is such a courageous, and sometimes the phone feels very, very heavy. And so I know that the connection, the honesty, the communication, that side is winning, so to speak. But this is a really hard time. It's really complicated. As often people say on the lines, and they'll say it to us explicitly, I just wish I got an instruction manual for my life. I wish I had some blueprint, or I wish I knew what to do. And of course, I feel that way too. So there's no manual for this period that we're in right now, but that we can talk about it makes it more manageable.
During this pandemic, is the approach or the language that is used by your team members any different than previously when you've received calls? Are there unique elements that you have to take into consideration, given everything that's going on?
This reminds me. So just a couple of days ago, we started our newest iteration of our training academy. So we have lots and lots and lots of volunteer crisis counselors, which is how I got in to start working at DD Hirsch. We have our hundreds of volunteer crisis counselors, and we're paraprofessionals, and we're here to support people on the phones and over the computers. And we also have our paid staff and our management team. And I remember when I was in the training academy, I was worried that I wasn't going to be able to talk to certain types of people who I didn't have a shared experience. I didn't know what they were talking about. I was worried that if a teenager was talking about self-harm, or an adult was talking about self-harm, or if someone was talking about a certain type of mental health concern or substance use or grief or loss, anything that I personally hadn't been through myself, I wouldn't have a well to draw on, and therefore I couldn't be helpful to them. And I would be wasting their time, and maybe I would hurt them. But what I learned in the training academy, and what those of us who were involved in this training academy is to teach and pay it forward to the new classes, is that you don't need to be an expert in anything, really. I mean, you don't need to be an expert in epidemiology, and you don't need to be an expert in COVID to be able to support someone. All you need to know is your own emotional experience, because we all go through the same stuff. And we all have experiences with these basic emotions. I just learned a couple months ago, there's just a handful of primary emotions that we all feel. And whether it's 5 or 7, we all feel mad. We all feel sad. We all feel glad. We all feel ashamed. And we all feel afraid. And so mad, sad, glad, afraid, ashamed. It's like the Inside Out movie. And we all have these. And so it's what a relief to me that I don't need to understand self-harm in order to connect with somebody who's experiencing self-injuries, self-harm behaviors, because we're connecting on a heart-to-heart level. You know, a lot of our calls start kind of brain to brain. You know, my name is Brian. What's going on? I'm so glad you called today. I want to hear more. And it starts brain to brain. It starts head to head, you know, intellectual. And then slowly, with the trust, really just that I can see you, I can hear you, I can try to understand. It's kind of like what Father Greg Boyle in Homeboy Industries, which I love his videos, and I love that we can all listen to him and watch him now, and or watch old commencement addresses. And he says that we don't go to the margins to fix people. We go to those spaces to receive people, to understand them, to hear them, so that the lines between us are erased. And I love that. So in the back to your question, has our language changed? I mean, it's certainly new topics of conversation. What do we say to someone who lost three family members in 3 months? What do you say to a grandma who wants to drive 12 hours to pick up her granddaughter who may be evicted and she's worried halfway through the 12-hour journey, she'll be turned around because of stay-at-home orders. And she asks, what should I do? So this is hard stuff, but yet we can still meet it and try to understand it without trying to fix it, which is a huge part of it and somewhat counterintuitive, I think. But so we don't need to be experts. And what a relief to us and to the callers. Sometimes people call and they want to find somebody on our lines who has that subject matter expertise, but it's great that, no, so long as we have an open heart and an open mind and are curious. And I think every time someone says empathy, I've started to think of other words too. When I hear empathy, I think of humility, because who am I to tell that grandma what to do? And who am I to try to tell that man how to grieve the loss of three family members? So humility, also curiosity. And I'm so grateful for Dee Dee Hirsch and the Suicide Prevention Center and the history of everybody who's come before me, that they've told me that if you're curious and you're humble and you're compassionate, you can't hurt someone with your words. You can't hurt someone with your questions, whether it's about suicide, whether it's about substance use. That's the thing about stigma that is so harmful. One of the most pernicious elements of the stigma around mental health and suicide, which is, and all the other topics, which is, if I ask you about it, I can make you worse. If I ask you about this, I can hurt you with my interest in your life. And that's not true. So yeah, we still do what we do. We still meet people where they're at. We still ask them questions. We still listen. And we're still curious. And it's amazing. It's really, really, really amazing.
Yeah, I think it's a very important point that you just made about still asking people about how they're feeling, even if we think it's a scary subject or we don't want to remind people of their pain or their loss. But of course, they are constantly thinking about it, and this just reaching out and asking those questions or just talking about it certainly helps.
Just reminded me, I talked to, and I haven't been at Dee Dee Hirsch for very long. I've been, it'll be 5 years this coming Thanksgiving. I started just around Thanksgiving 5 years ago. And I remember early on, I got a call from a guy who called and said that he wanted to talk to, I think it was his father who died. And the circumstances of the father's death, it wasn't as though he was calling about a suicide of his father, and he was a survivor. He was a lost survivor. But this is what I remember, is he called and he said, tomorrow's the anniversary of my dad's death, and no one will talk to me about him. And he said this, he said, I can feel that people are worried to talk to me about my dad because tomorrow's the anniversary. And he said what a lot of people say, and a lot of people think and feel. I feel this way sometimes. It's like, it's a sense that you're looking at somebody and you think that they think that if they say that they talk to you, they're going to break you or something, or that I'm brittle and that I can't handle talking about my father who died a year ago. And then he said, I called today because I just want to say his name, and no one will say his name. No one is saying my dad's full name right now. They're alluding to it, and then they're kind of scurrying off and say, okay, I got to go. And he said, I just want to talk about my dad. I just want to say his name. And as you can tell, that really left a mark on me, because it was like, yeah, people just want to talk. People just want to talk. People want to be seen. People want to tell their story. We all want to be seen. And right now we're all stuck in our homes and our apartments, but we still want to be seen. I still want to be seen. It's not the accolades and it's not the criticism. I just want to be seen. And that is an amazing thing that we do, and it's possible over the phone. You don't necessarily have to be looking into someone's eyes to say, I see you. In fact, you don't, you can be wearing a mask, you can be talking over the phone, you can be texting, even over a letter that says, I'm thinking of you. I see you, I like you for just the way you are. I'm so glad that we're talking right now. And it's so interesting that the medium, whether it's phone, computer, letter, text, email, it's all possible. And it all works.
Yeah. I remember reading Sheryl Sandberg's and Adam Grant's book, Option B, where she talked about that after the loss of her husband, how people stopped asking questions. They stopped, you know, checking in simply because, like you said, they were scared of breaking her or something like that.
I can tell you something else, which I've been reflecting on because we're taking many more calls. I mean, our numbers, then we had, I think it was a 75-fold increase from February to March on COVID-related calls. I mean, so we're getting a tremendous number of calls, and we're a 24/7 operation. And so we're answering calls from the Suicide Prevention Center, our phone number. We're answering calls from the National Crisis Line, the 1-800-273-TALK or 1-800-273-8255. We also answer calls from the Teen Line, which is an amazing service, which is for trained teens to talk to other teens in a peer supportive capacity. And that's amazing. However, right now, teens are not able to staff the teen line over the phone. Teens are still answering texts and emails. So we are now exclusively answering the teen line calls for teens in distress. Oh, and also our Spanish, we have a Spanish language program. So we're answering calls for a Spanish language as well as Korean. But the big one right now is the disaster distress helpline. So we're answering calls from all over the country for people who have concerns related to a disaster. But this is the amazing thing. I used to think I had to change myself to meet the caller or be what the caller needed. And over time, I realized that the caller is taking the lead. It changed my life, literally. It's changed my life, starting as a volunteer and now completely changing the direction of my life. Now I'm a proud social worker, went back to school. But it changed my life initially because the honesty and the vulnerability that I heard on the phone, and we all hear on the phones, it's incredible.
One thing that's quite unique to everything that's currently going on is that a lot of people are losing loved ones without the possibility to see them and say goodbye in person or even have a proper burial or celebration of life afterward. So, yeah, this is really, really, really hard for a lot of people right now.
Absolutely. You know, here in LA, the mayor's office has a crisis response team. I'm a part of that volunteer team, and it's been around for 25 years that we go out and we support people in a volunteer capacity. We support families who are going through that immediate crisis and loss from a homicide, a suicide, an accidental death, or a natural death. But right now, we're not able to go out too, so we're following up with families. And so between my experience with the crisis response team and with Dee Dee Hirsch on the crisis hotline, and also just seeing what's happening in the world, it's really, really hard because it's hard to connect right now. I just had a call the other day. Someone was calling to say that they lost their grandmother and they weren't able to say goodbye and they weren't able to attend the funeral. He wanted to talk about it and we did. And, you know, there's a time for grief work. You know, I mean, like our house, for example, in Los Angeles is a great organization where people can come together in a peer capacity, you know, sit with other people and do grief work. But what do we say and what do we do? And with this gentleman the other day, he said, I couldn't be there with my grandma who raised me. I couldn't be there at the funeral. I couldn't say goodbye. I couldn't see her. And he felt stuck. This is hard when we get stuck. And so what do we do when we get stuck? And this is a lot about grief work, actually, is what happens when we get stuck. For some people, getting stuck on images, memories, or feelings, or if I could have gotten to the hospital, or if I could have had one more conversation, or I wish that last fight hadn't happened, or those, we get stuck. And that's one of the hardest parts of grief. And so the first thing to do, well, first is an awareness that we're stuck. And sometimes it takes time. I'm glad that this young man called the other day to talk about how he was feeling stuck. Again, in an environment where there was no judgment. It was, I hope, valuable for him that he had an opportunity to talk about how he was feeling, what was happening in his life, and that he was having trouble sleeping and eating. I hope he didn't feel anything from me that was judging him or telling him how he was doing his life right or wrong. Or, Brené Brown, right? Everybody loves Brené Brown. She's amazing. And so when she talks about shame, and she has the three elements of shame that really are pronounced, like the three variables, I don't know if I'm saying that right, but three things that make shame go. And that would be silence, secrecy, and judgment. And so I think at the crisis hotline and all of DD Hirsch, I mean, all of our services, whether it's substance use or domestic violence or kids programs. And what we do is we try to do the opposite. You know, things are not silent. We can talk about them. They're not secret. Sometimes we can say things to a stranger or a trusted person who's not on our inner circle. And then finally, without judgment. The non-judgmental attitude. And so when there's a conversation without judgment that has honesty, that has patience, that allows for silences, all that stuff, we can be present in the conversation. We can actually hear what's being said. And when I'm talking to somebody, like I'm talking to you right now, for these moments where I'm feeling present, I'm actually able to hear what I'm saying. I'm not thinking about what I just answered, and I'm not thinking about what your next question is. During the day, we're thinking about the future and the past all the time. At least I am, and I think a lot, there's a lot of us out there who do. And so on the crisis line, we have this space and time where we can drop into the right now without judgment, and so that callers and chatters on the computer can actually have the experience of hearing themselves talk. And hearing themselves say what they need to say and hearing the things they need to hear. And it comes from their own mouths, it comes from their own heart. So this gentleman can say, I miss my grandma and I wish I could have said goodbye. And I love her so much. And so that is the healing. Feeling is healing. And so he had all the answers himself. And sometimes it's the questions that really matter. The questions are just as if not more important than the answers. So for him, he could ask, he could say, I wonder what I could have said to my grandma, or I wonder what her funeral service could have been like had we all been there. And he could hear himself ask that question out loud, and he can be with that. Back to your question about death and dying and grief and loss and bereavement right now, there are options. I'm reading about how there's a lot of people who are using technology to help people connect over Zoom for bereavement and memorials. And that's great. And there's still an opportunity for us all to connect and talk about what it's like for this young man to talk about how he's feeling without anybody telling him how to feel. It's simple, but it's not easy because it's hard to find safe relationships in the world. It's hard to find those safe contexts to talk, but that's our job. That's what we do.
In the disaster psychology courses I've taken, I've learned that the best thing to do when someone is experiencing trauma or grief is to simply lend an ear and paraphrase what the person said to you, because nothing you say can take away their loss and or pain. Is that something that you would recommend if to people who, right now are having someone who's struggling and they just want to talk and you may not have experience talking to someone who's in that situation. Is that a good thing to do?
Yeah, that I think that's great. I think that's really, really great. Sometimes people, when someone's crying and you hand them a tissue, right? And I remember hearing that there's some in like some grief support groups for facilitators, they do their best not to hand someone a tissue when they're crying. This is for facilitators. I mean, a therapist or a facilitator, if seeing someone's crying, will not hand them a tissue. And that just came to my mind because, again, allowing someone to have their experience and also acknowledge it. And so what you asked about is acknowledging it and paraphrasing something back. It's a lot. I mean, it is a huge thing for someone to be acknowledged. Sometimes I think that by paraphrasing someone, what someone says back, the mindset or the philosophy behind that, imagine that I am a mirror and I am allowing the person to see themselves. And I want to do my best not to distort how this person is feeling. I spent a lot of my life walking around kind of like a funhouse mirror. You look at me and I'll make you look different. I'll make you look better. Let me cheer you up. But if I'm able to be there, stand still, literally and figuratively, and paraphrase back. Sometimes I worry I don't know what to say to people. And guess what? They tell me what I should say to them. People teach us, as I think it was Oprah, who said, people teach us how to treat them. And when people are saying, I'm so lost and I don't know what to do, they just told us something about what's going on inside of them. And we don't need to find a bigger word. We don't need to find a smaller word. They just said they feel lost and they don't know what to do. And we can also hear how people are speaking. I can hear your voice is so low and you're whispering, and this must be so hard. I can hear you're crying. Of course, this is hard. And so paraphrasing is a great way for us to better connect. It's simple. It's not easy, like a lot of these things, because we don't like to see other people who are struggling, who are upset. I'm glad you brought it up, because it's nice to have things that we can remember to do. Is that I don't need to find a better word than lost. If that's what they said, they feel lost. And if they feel lost, it's okay that they feel lost. It's okay. It is.
Earlier, you touched on this already. There continues to be stigma around mental health. How can we go about erasing that stigma?
Yeah, that's a great question. And today is May 1st, and it is Mental Health Awareness Month. So I'm really glad we're talking today. There's a lot that we can do. And right now, because of the disaster and what we're all going through, people are thinking about mental health and physical health a lot more, which is great. I mean, we're thinking about our outer lives and our inner lives too. And I'm really proud to be part of an organization that is always looking for opportunities to better erase the stigma and continue to move the ball down the field. Every year we actually, for a long time, we've had Erase the Stigma galas. And even this year, we continued in that tradition to talk about those people who, in their own professions and their own spaces and their own lived experiences, are doing that and encouraging others to do so. At the end of April, Dee Hirsch launched the first ever Erase the Stigma campaign to raise awareness for all these efforts. And it's actually continuing through May. Let me just give you the website, because there's a lot of great stuff on there. It's www.erasingthestigma.org. So www.erasingthestigma.org. And so you can actually watch a video of the presentation. There's a lot of great stuff on there. We have a hand washing campaign. There's also an opportunity to gifts of support for our services like ours at the crisis line, and also for a lot of the other Dee Hirsch locations. As I said before, we have 10 locations throughout Los Angeles. We're in 100 schools each year, and we're still working hard to support kids and families and adults. We helped 150,000 children and adults last year. It's amazing. At the crisis line, we talked to 130,000 people last year. So we're all working hard to acknowledge the stigmas. That's the first part, an important part of erasing the stigma, is to acknowledge that there's still stigmas, there's still misperceptions. People still feel or think that if we talk about these things, it can be damaging. Now, it can be disruptive. I mean, it can be difficult. I took a meditation or mindfulness class a bunch of years ago, and the teacher told us that in the first week of the class, in this first of 8 weeks, you're going to probably feel worse. And it doesn't mean you're doing anything wrong. It doesn't mean you're meditating wrong. It means you are feeling more. And people's experience in therapy, individual or group therapy, and or exercise, yoga, anything. At the beginning, it's painful or it can feel uncomfortable. Being uncomfortable is not the same as being dangerous. You know, difficult is not the same as dangerous. For me, the worst parts of the stigmas are that it's dangerous to talk about suicide or it's dangerous to talk about depression. It's not dangerous, it's difficult because it's scary to talk about how I feel. This is hard to talk about my feelings of loneliness or isolation. It's hard. The stigma is being erased. The good news is that we've already started. It's happening with every conversation, but there's a lot more work to be done. And we're doing it one conversation or one donation at a time. And it all helps.
Your job must have quite the emotional toll on you. What do you do to handle your stress level?
When I was in school in social work, I remember them saying that social workers can, from time to time, preach self-care, but practice self-sacrifice. I was just talking to some counselors and other supervisors the other day. It's like, sometimes it feels kind of straightforward when you hear someone talking about what's going on in their life. Sometimes it can seem straightforward to give other people advice, you know, advice is free, you know, and so we don't give advice on our lines. But if you know, if you follow me, it's easy to tell other people what you think they should do with their life. But for myself, what do I need? The first time I ever cried on the lines, it was from a heartbreaking story. But the thing that really got me was this young man who was so positive and so optimistic about his future, despite having so much thrown at him. And I cried after the call because if it was me in his shoes, I don't think I could have even like a tenth of his hope and self-love. He really loved himself and how far he had come. So what do? I've learned now that feeling sad or overwhelmed or frustrated or feeling like I was not enough at the end of a call, I don't have to keep that to myself anymore. I thought for a long time that maybe if I feel depleted or exhausted at the end of a tough shift, that meant that I wasn't good at my job. It just means I'm doing my best. I'm putting my heart into it as much as I can. And I don't have to carry that alone anymore, which is precisely what callers are talking about too. They're calling and they're saying, I'm carrying this alone, whatever it is, and I don't know what to do. And we say to them, I'm so glad you called. Let's talk about what you're carrying right now. And let's talk about how heavy it feels. And then for us counselors and supervisors and people who work in this space, we also can sometimes feel like things feel heavy. And sometimes it feels like I don't want to tell anybody how heavy this feels. But we can do that too. So I do my best to debrief with my supervisor and my colleagues and counselors too, even telling them. The callers are so honest with us, and the callers give me the confidence that I can be honest too in my life. And that means saying, I don't know, or asking for help. And sometimes the help is telling somebody that I'm struggling. I can't meditate right now. I don't know what to do. Can you give me some ideas on other things to do? And someone might say, well, have you tried these like coloring mandalas, you know, coloring things? And it's just like giving me another idea. We all need help. Can be really helpful just to get permission from someone on the outside to say, Brian, you're doing okay. Keep going. And so I can talk to my supervisor. I can talk to my friends. I can take a break from suicide prevention. If I'm doing okay, I can remind myself that it's okay. And the emotional toll is understandable. And as Mr. Rogers says, he said every episode was just about one thing, because he's talking about safety. He's talking about having kids being able to find those adults or caregivers who they feel safe with. And he said that if something is mentionable, it's more manageable. He just wanted people to know that if you can just get it out and have someone else who you trust see it and hear it, things can feel more manageable. So this is a work in progress for me. And, but you know, conversations like this are helpful to remind me that I don't have to be perfect either. In fact, being perfect is not possible, and it's not helpful. When callers are in crisis, they don't want to talk to a perfect person. They want to talk to a person who doesn't have all the answers, but is trying to figure out life also, and that we can figure out life together.
Brian, thank you so much for speaking with me today and sharing about mental health and everything that we all can do to help one another during these times. You and all of your colleagues and all of the volunteers, you really are our mental health heroes. Thank you. I'd like to close off this episode by giving a heartfelt thanks to Brian and all other mental health heroes out there. Despite the seriousness of this issue, I hope you were able to take away the rays of positivity as well. We can all be empathetic, loving, and caring toward each other. I encourage everyone to participate in the Erasing the Stigma campaign by completing the handwashing challenge. Visit erasingthestigma.org to read more and tag COVID-19_heroes for us to share it. And if you do need to talk to someone, there are incredible resources out there. I have listed some crisis hotline numbers, websites, and text message numbers in the episode description. Stay well, stay healthy, and until next time, I'm your host, Lorraine Schneider.